Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf online at sunburymotors.com. Ford Kia Hyundai, best in new inventory. Great pre-owned inventory as well with the Sunbury Motors Guarantee. That is critical. That means something. Put some backbone behind it. Great sales staff that works with you, and also the service department, second to none. Difficult to routine? They've got it. All at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf and online. And at sunburymotors.com. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day.
Only a couple of steps behind. Toss comes to the near side for Harris. He runs through a big hole, and he's gone to the 50. A burst to the 40. Alone to the 20. Damien Harris to the house. Touchdown, Patriots.
What a block by Jakob Johnson.
Bob Soci and Scott Zolak, I believe, with the call on the Patriots Radio Network. That touchdown and the subsequent two-point conversion allowed the Patriots to never deviate from their game plan because they played with the lead all night. That's okay. You can have a genius plan that works because you never have to deviate from the plan. And the Patriots never had to deviate from it. Never did. Because they had the lead the entire time. Nothing forced them to change up. Because their defense made it stand up. They had enough offense to stay in front. That two-point conversion, which happened after the Harris touchdown run, hung over the game the entire time. Now it's 8-7. It's 11-10. Kick a field goal, it's 14-10. Now you need a touchdown. Just hung over the entire game. You can have a great game plan, and if you never have to change it, it is a great game plan. They never had to change. All right. Been too long. Tony Knapp. The suit hates this segment because we're talking about money and not about the glorious sports. Tony, welcome. Great to have you with us on the show.
How are you? Good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk with you, Tony. Great. A lot to cover here. A lot.
The world went crazy. Yeah, it's only been 6 weeks, and college football is drunk, and the IOC is doing crazy things, and tennis players are disappearing. It's crazy.
It's unbelievable. So let's start with the, quote, China issue. The United States, there'll be no diplomatic presence. I'm like, you know, something tells me China's only sitting there and they go, oh my God, really? oh no. What do we do now? But there have been some people that have talked boycott. Nobody's going to boycott. What is the economic impact for China, and have any companies backed away because it is China?
So I will answer the question with the business hat on and not with my moral and ethical hat on.
Yes,
what I am saying is what is going to happen and how they're considering it, not how I would consider it. So
right.
That's my form of qualification.
Yes.
This, much like you're never going to hear LeBron James say free Hong Kong because he has too much economic interest in it, you're never going to hear NBC or the sponsors pull away from the China Olympic Games simply because you've got Paris, you've got Los Angeles, you've got Milan, you've got massive games upcoming that are economic just booms, and IOC knows it, probably why they slated it that way and picked the cities and countries that they did. So despite the fact that I think everybody, you know, with a cold mic that wouldn't be tracked would say that they would like to do things differently and, you know, possibly put some pain on China. They do know that if they do that, the IOC has shown that they are incredibly, that they operate like the mob. And if you do something like that to them and to the host city that they chose, there's going to be consequence for it in the future. So as much as we'd like there to be this movement about human rights catastrophes that are happening and to see brands, you know, just pull away completely, they're just going to try to quietly distance themselves in the hopes that they can capitalize on the three big games that are coming.
Right. So let's start with something I think people don't realize. You and I both know this. Beijing, by a 44-40 vote, beat out the only other bidder, and that was Kazakhstan. This was not a games that was heavily bid on. Everyone thought Oslo would get it, and they backed out. Is this, since then, it's been, okay, Paris, L.A., they're going to split. They got Milan, right? So they've got the next three, and we already know where 32 is going. It's going to Brisbane. Yeah. It seems like the IOC has been very careful about selection and not bidding between now and 32. Is that fair?
Because I think there's a couple of things that have gone along with this, and I think we're seeing FIFA make a realization of this as well. You know, they always say never make a decision when you're in an extreme state, right? Never make a decision when everything's going so well, and never make a decision when things are going terribly wrong. When, you know, FIFA and the IOC were flying high on the hog for a while there, they saw that this was an opportunity for them to maybe cash in and go to some more developing countries that were cash rich, that were willing to pay for this. So you have a World Cup that's in Qatar, you have an Olympic Games that was in South Korea in Pyeongchang, and then you have one that's back in Beijing, even though we were just in Beijing in 2008. I think they realized, you know, in that time span, as people started to fall off, as Boston pulled out of their bid because the city got sued, as Chicago, you know, their bid didn't really show the way they were hoping it to, that maybe it's time for them to start going back to some of the glamour ones and paint the games with a little bit better picture. What a lot of people don't realize is this is not new. This is kind of the way the games were going before the 1984 LA games.
Right.
Changed the way the economics worked, and they started selling a bunch of sponsorships, and they showed that, hey, this could be an economic boom for the region. And I think they're getting back to that playbook right now, and that's why there's rumors about Salt Lake City coming back in, and cities that, you know, just 2, 3, 4 years ago would have stayed overnight.
All right, so let's shift from that, may return to it here, and let's get to the college football playoff. They're going to delay whatever they're doing till January, and it sounds like January is the last time they feel they can do something and have it be viable for 2024.
Yeah.
Okay, now the Alliance, which, you know, I'm not exactly in there. I don't get why is the Big Ten doing it? I'm sitting there like going, who sat down and said, hey, this is a great idea? No, it's not a great idea. But they're saying, we'd be content with 8. You and I both know, Tony, if you go to 8, ESPN already owns all the New Year's Six bowl games with contracts, so they're going to get no more money out of it. You got to go to 12 to get more money. Is that really the simple answer right there?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, I'm going to answer with what the business...
Yeah, I totally got it.
...to what I agree with, right? Yeah, so, right. Like, you and I would both agree that, you know, hey, it makes more sense to have 12 or even go to what the subdivision has done, where they have a playoff that's economically viable, that crowns a national champion, that has, you know, conference champions go in. And it's very simple, you know, if we were starting from scratch, this is what we do. But we're not starting from scratch. We have a lot of economic debt, so to speak, that's tied to this system. And when you're talking about moving to 8, now you're talking about taking bowl games that have a lot of economic interest tied to them. They have, you know, financial obligations that are tied to local banks, local sponsors, local teams, all those things, and they're paid in by ESPN, and you're changing their value on a year-to-year basis. And that's how businesses are financed. If you're going to now go back and say, you know, if I was the Rose Bowl and I could say every year I have a big opportunity for a marquee game for Ohio State to play USC or for Penn State to play Washington, and now I'm telling you that my game is going to be a little undervalued every other year or every 3 years, that changes everything for them economically. That's built over time. So it's just not that easy to come in and say, this is the way we should do it, so let's go do it, because you have people who created an entire business around it and they're living. And so you're right. What they're trying to do now because you hear them talk about it. You hear Mike Bone talk about it. You hear Slavik talk about it. And they say, look, we wanted to leak this to the public in advance so that we can kind of get ahead of the PR as we start to make that decision. I think what they're trying to understand is, you know, there's a goal that they have in place, and in order for them to get to that goal, they've got to walk through a lot of really just ugly public relations. Like, it's going to come out as to why it took a while to do this, and I don't know if they have a stomach for it. You know, like, the best analogy I would draw is, you know, I was talking to some guys who are involved in the Crypto.com Arena deal with Staples Center, and their SVP of marketing said something really interesting. He said, we don't care what you call it. That's not the point of this deal. Right? If you don't call it Crypto.com Arena for the next 4 years, we don't care. We have a longer vision in this. And that's how they're looking at this. They're saying, look, we know this is going to be stinky for a few years, but we have to grease the right palms. It's not that much different than, unfortunately, the conversation we just had about the IOC in China.
Right.
Right. Like, here, we want to get to this 12-game playoff, but we're going to have to pay off some bulls and some people that maybe aren't the most outstanding along the way for them to walk away from, you know, business that they've been relying on for a number of years.
Well, what's interesting about this is that you can do that with the home games in the opening round, then incorporate the bowls. I think that there's an appeasement level there. But there's one. Let's get to the part, and you're very close to this. You know personally how I feel about the Rose Bowl. I don't like the Rose Bowl. I love the Rose Bowl. Okay, simple. I mean, I don't just like it. I love it. And all you have to do is go there once. You've been many times. I've been there three times. And you look around and go, you know what? This is what I grew up on. Yet in this, the Rose Bowl is an issue in the playoff as to how they fit in this. Is there any talk as to how it works and how the Rose Bowl continues to work in the structure of a 12-team playoff?
I think they know the chip that they hold, right?
Yes.
And I think there's a belief in talking to the people that I know who are involved in these processes, there's a belief that, well, maybe the younger generation doesn't have as much of an affinity to the Rose Bowl as like I do or like you do, right? And it's turning out that that's not the case. They actually do have an affinity to this, to the Rose Bowl parade, to the idea behind this. And that's what we're talking about. It's really similar to trying to balance the interests of where you're going to put the Olympic Games when you know that, you know, Paris is going to be a monster, but you can't have it in Paris every time because everybody has their hand out and they want it somewhere else.
Right.
So then you end up having one in Sochi, right?
Yeah.
And eventually, Paris says, well, look, you know, we can just run our own events. And we're going to do just fine by ourselves. And that's the shit that the Rose Bowl is playing here.
Yep.
And they're playing it very well. They're saying, look, we're the granddaddy of them all. We know economically where we are on this. There's also a lot of community involvement in the Rose Bowl and money that goes into the community that's tied to it. So it's a really, you do a really great job of kind of laying it out for the listeners. That yes, you know, even though when you sit down, you say a 16-team playoff makes all the sense in the world, it does, but we're not starting from zero. Right? We have all these things in place.
Yes.
Now you have people who have, you know, they have more tradition, they have more money, they have more, and they have the ability to say, we'll do this ourselves and really, really damage what you're trying to build.
Right.
And look, when they talk about the first home game being, you know, at the school, now you have the conferences arguing over, well, does the school get all the money or do we?
Right. Exactly.
Right? Well, you wouldn't have that home game unless you played and won our conference. So now, hey, USC, you're hosting the game. I mean, it comes down to, you know, the downfall of the Pac-12 and the buildup of the Big Ten.
Yeah.
Well, it's because back in the early 10s and in the mid-2000s, you know, the Big Ten understood what you were talking about. They said, look, we have premium teams. Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan. We know that there has to be an unfair balance of revenue share, money, et cetera, and priority that goes to those because when they succeed, the entire conference rises with them. The SEC did the same thing, right? The Pac-10 didn't. The Pac-10 had Washington State and Oregon State coming in throwing a big fit, saying, no, we can't give priority to the LA schools.
Right.
And that's, we talk a lot here about the English Premier League. That's how they do it there. When you play in the English Premier League, you don't get the same amount of money for being, you know, the bottom of the table team that you do from the top. And it's not really based on how you finish. It's based on who you are as a club.
Right.
Arsenal, Chelsea, City, they get more money than, you know, Burnley and Crystal Palace and Leeds do.
Well, this is the Rose Bowl, to give everybody a little perspective. They are the masters. The year they looked at advertisers and said, you know what? we don't want to put you guys in peril for a year, so we'll just go it alone for a year. And they did it. Not many entities can do that. The Rose Bowl and the Masters can.
Augusta National can.
Yep.
Right? And that's why when people get so frustrated by this, and they're more frustrated, I was actually hoping that there'd be a little bit different play out of the Big Ten so you and I could be on the same side of the argument for a change.
Yeah.
The Pac-12 gets left out every year, right? So there's this argument that, like, hey, you know, you need more teams for the Pac-12 game. And I was kind of hoping that with the Big Ten being as strong as it was this year, there was going to be the argument that two teams did it.
Right.
And then a couple teams lost at the end, and that didn't play out that way. But you talk to anybody, and they see that argument, and they believe that it should be so simple. And then you start to lay out, like, well, you know, it's not much different than how the mafia approaches a neighborhood, right? You have a couple of stores you got to get out of the way, and they're making good money. Why would they want to join your alliance? Right?
Right. Exactly. All right, so now let's shift gears now to they're not being hurt at all by being locked out, but because they aren't playing any games. What kind does Major League Baseball understand the dangerous game they're playing right now with the fans? That they are they naive enough to think that they're so wildly popular that they can get away with missing some games, parts of a season? I mean, are they that delusional?
I'm going to get in trouble here. Yes. Not all of them. But those in power, yes. Baseball has a belief. And, you know, they had a former head of MLB in there, Bob Bowman, who has since been removed. I would say dishonorably discharged, so to speak. he used to regularly give a speech that, you know, in 1950, the top three sports were boxing, horse racing, and baseball. Baseball is the only one left. And we always thought that was an interesting way of framing this, because you're not really paying attention. You're saying, look, we have this massive growth and everything's going well, but you're not looking at your neighbors who are the NFL and the NBA and looking at their growth. You're not pacing with their growth. So there's still this old guard in baseball between owners and some of the people that are in the commissioner's office who do believe that, you know, that they have the ability to withstand this the way the Masters of the Rose Bowl do. And often they'll point to participation numbers for kids and that sort of thing, but they just kind of gloss over the ratings numbers. They say, oh, the ratings are good and, you know, attendance isn't that bad, but when you compare it to the people on their block, it is.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the argument. I think the biggest problem that baseball has right now, and they've been talking about it, is just this understanding that if the game changed completely, they're way more reliant on younger players, and the younger players don't make that much money. And so they're trying to... The players want to bring this into the kind of agreement that a revenue-sharing agreement like the NFL, the NBA, and the NHL have. And baseball is not interested in doing that. So much like, you know, the bowl games, it knows to spite the face, but they know once they go there, they're never coming back. Right? Once you go to revenue share, you can't go back.
That's right.
The way it is now. And where the baseball, where the listeners may not understand, is that baseball was more predicated on the RSNs than anybody.
Yep.
So RSNs are the regional sports networks where the teams sometimes owned them or they partnered with them, and they collected all of the money. There was no national revenue share on the money for these regional sports networks. The regional sports networks are doing terribly now. They're in carriage wars with all of the different providers. You know, there's a lot of cities where it's even blacked out, where for here we couldn't watch Dodger games for 2 years unless you were Time Warner only.
Exactly.
And the Dodgers were playing in the World Series those years. And so the owners are looking at this, and the world is changing around them, and they don't like it. And so you ask, like, are they naive enough to believe this is the case? Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
And just like anybody would look at the college football playoff and say, 16 makes sense. Just like anybody would look at the World Cup and say, you shouldn't play it in Qatar. Just like anybody would look at that and say, probably shouldn't go to Beijing, right?
Nope.
You just have all of these things that push them on the business side into making poor decisions, which are generally based on greed and money.
I'm shocked that you would say that. I can't believe you'd actually come to that conclusion. All right, I do have to close out with this. I'm looking forward to a fun day when it's James Franklin on one sideline and Lincoln Riley on the other. How happy were you as a USC guy that suddenly they said, you know what? Mike Bone is going to get Lincoln Riley to be the head football coach at your school.
Who saw that coming? I certainly didn't. I wanted Franklin, to be honest, because I just like him as a person, too.
Oh, he's phenomenal.
You guys locked him up with that long-term deal. I think his buyout's like $50 million now. Yeah. So he's not going anywhere.
Right.
The one I'm really excited about, and I think what's gotten a little bit glossed over as college football's gotten drunk, is Lincoln Riley's Trojans are opening the season against Brian Kelly's LSU Tigers in 2024 in Vegas.
Oh.
Each team will have 2 years to rebuild. It's going to be fun to actually matter. This team's been so bad for so long.
Right.
It'll be nice if they actually matter again.
Well, they're going to matter, no doubt. All right. So let's rectify a major mistake, and let's not take this long between conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah, anytime. I'm welcome to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Tony, thanks so much. Happy holidays to you and that beautiful family of yours. My goodness, getting bigger.
It's so fast. So fast.
Yeah. Tony, thanks so much. Happy holidays, my friend.
You too, you and yours. We'll talk soon.
Tony Knopp joining us from Los Angeles, sitting in a corner office right now, depressed over the segment, the suit, because it just rips away the veneer that sports is John Facenda narrating the frozen tundra to the suit that's sports. The reality is, it's a business. Just ask Matt. They asked Matt, what does the Steve Jones Show mean to you? And Matt said about $1 billion a year contractually. Back with more in a moment.
L-E-D, that spells out.
Back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WK.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Home of the no complaint half hour. Thus, Matt has the cone of silence.
And a 10-foot radius.
Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, online at sunburymotors.com. Ford, Kia, Hyundai, the best in new inventory. Great pre-owned inventory with the Sunbury Motors guarantee to back it up. Great sales staff. Your trade-in's never been worth more. And also a fabulous service department to back it all up. From the difficult to the routine, they got you covered. It's all at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, online at sunburymotors.com. All right, the Steelers pulled the fat out of the fire with a big second half and a stopped two-point conversion. A call, by the way, by John Harbaugh I agree with. I mean, it didn't work, but I agree with them making the call. I didn't do the same thing. But it did, so good for them. But the Steelers stopped it. Neil, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Neil, T.J. Watt, otherwise known in this broadcast as Double D Direct Deposit, came up with a good game. Not only came up with a good game, but really made a heck of a play on the two-point conversion. What is the domino impact when he is on the field and at least playing at a credible level?
Like what we've seen is, I think domino effect's a good way to put it. I would say it like this. You have a Steelers team that is, in my opinion, marginally talented, good enough to remain competitive in most of the games they've played this season. In those competitive games, the Steelers are now 6-1-1, and
yes.
T.J. Watt has been an instrumental part of most of those six wins.
Very fair.
Especially later in the game.
Yes.
Like we just saw. He had a sack not even seven plays before the two-point conversion. Did knocked Baltimore back a bit. Pittsburgh's defense couldn't, you know, lock it down at the end, but Watt did his part late in the game. This is a game he had 3.5 sacks, but one of them came late at least. He made plays early in the game, and that two-point play, from an athletic standpoint, that's a big ask. I mean, it's not as easy as you think it might be. Rushing off of the edge, really on instinct. He doesn't know what's happening in that situation, and that's what plays like that are counting on. Watt rushes in, and more than anything, he's smart enough to not run straight at Jackson, in which case Jackson would have shook him and lost him and had an open throw or a wide open running lane. He went right to his outside hip and then over a little bit to force Jackson to step up as opposed to step out. If he steps out, he's got his shortstop throw thing that broadcasters love to comment on. Andrews is wide open because, well, he's running behind where Watt is. You know, imagine that. Baltimore wanted to force Watt into that decision. That's exactly what that play was. That going the defense's way is not the typical result of that play. The Ravens run those kinds of force option plays at a pretty high frequency, especially at the goal line, and they're very successful with it. It was a monster play, and one that probably won't get as much technical attention as it should, but you can't define a big-time moment for anybody better than that, and Watt is the one who won it.
Yeah, no question. You go through a game where, in the first half, where they had the ball, 6.5 minutes, 6:45, some number like that, which is that's just a recipe for disaster. What did they find offensively in the second half, Neil?
part of me wants to say it's the now rising legend of something called John McGlue, or John Luglu. See, I did it again. I jokingly had made a comment when he went into the game, because he's the fourth left guard to play a snap there this season for the Steelers. At one point, I called him Muglu, and I just jokingly said, there's something called John Luglu out on the field right now. To be honest, though, that guy was tearing it up on those last couple drives. It looked like it took him maybe a little bit to kind of get warm, but he had a monster fourth quarter. He was really throwing his weight around inside. I was inspired by it. I was excited by it. It was really fun to see a Steelers offensive lineman having such success. We haven't seen a whole lot of that this year. I'm not sure if it wasn't Baltimore, just their tongues were dragging on the ground at the end. I'm not sure. They really kind of seemed to lay down. I mean, it's not typical. I mean, Tony Romo said this in the broadcast 5 or 6 times. You can't run on the Ravens. Well, fourth quarter, the Steelers ran all over the Ravens.
Yeah.
It wasn't they weren't competing at all up front. And you saw Matt Canada seemed to get wise to that, and he kept moving LeGlue into spots. He was pulling him. He shot him up to the second level. He wasn't just doing your standard gap blocking like they usually do. He seemed fresh more than anybody else.
Yeah.
He was really carving room for Harris to run, make a move or two, elude a tackle, and instead of getting 2 yards a carry, he was all of a sudden getting 5. And that allowed them to really just suck the air out of the ball late and put themselves into position to take a lead with a field goal, or, you know, take a touchdown lead with a touchdown at a 2-point, which is what they did. It was the least probable set of circumstances, I think, going into a quarter as I've seen in a Steelers game in a very long time. I wrote them off. I thought that was over at halftime. A couple of calls don't go their way. It looked like it's just kind of one of those games that Baltimore is just going to kind of squeeze them throughout the rest of the time, not really have to take chances to get the ball back, and then, you know, just use a great special teams unit and a good running game to salt away a win. But Pittsburgh was the team that did exactly that. Defensively, they came together. They played really well. And for the first time in a while now, a couple weeks, it really looked like their run game it dominated at the end. I would not have expected that to happen, certainly not behind the new hero in John McGlue.
And he is the new hero. It's interesting. Why? What I find interesting is Baltimore dragging in the fourth quarter defensively, because they didn't play at all in the first half. They were only on the field for 6.5 minutes. How can you be dragging in the second half? Should have been the freshest unit on the field.
Right? I mean, it's how about this on top of it? T.J. Watt's the one who missed the entire week on COVID.
COVID, and he looked fresh.
There were rumors going around about Cam Hayward's illness. Trey Turner was injured. He was ill as well at one point this week. The Steelers clearly have had COVID running around the locker room a bit. You'd think if anybody would be dead, it'd be the Steelers. It kind of seemed like they came alive. And to your point, yeah, Baltimore, their defense didn't play in the first quarter.
Right.
They got spotted 15 minutes. I don't know what happened. I just, watching the film again, it wasn't like the entire Steelers offensive line was just on top of them and making them crumble. Baltimore just seemed to kind of make contact and fall back. It really just didn't look like they had any gas left. And exactly as you said, I don't understand why that would have been the case.
Right.
It didn't make sense to me, but Pittsburgh didn't care either. It really well-called fourth quarter. They handled their business exactly as they planned to do it. And up until, you know, Lamar Jackson coming to life a little bit, making some nice plays before the two-point conversion, looked like they were going to put the game away.
Right. Now, the short week with Minnesota. Neil, is there any way to predict the performance of the two teams playing on Thursday night, Minnesota and Pittsburgh? To me, these are two incredibly unpredictable teams that can play really, really well or play really, really poor.
You know, there have been a lot of people in the gambling community in particular that ask me about the differences between a Sunday game and a Thursday game. And the reality is, in a Thursday game, you have no idea, except in situations where the teams don't know each other particularly well, which is what you have Thursday. And it's also why up until this year they changed it around. But they used to only play division games on Thursday just to have – a familiarity with your opponent, to start fresh.
And one quick point. Normally, the way in Ben's pattern is he doesn't usually return to practice till Thursday.
Yeah, exactly. Veterans even have the day off as well. They give the rule is you have to give a presumed injury report leading into a Thursday game.
Yeah,
there were multiple Steelers who were on that anyway, Ben being one of them. They have him listed as injured. Probably going to have it that way all season, but that'd be a coach's decision for him. They gave it to Cam and Trey Turner as well, which I think we can expect for the remainder of the season. But it's assumed that they're hurt, you know, leading into the Wednesday practice, which comes on Monday, which is a treatment and film day, Tuesday, which is a day off following the game. Now all of a sudden you're right on top of that, and we're already, you know, halfway through their practice schedule. So health is a major thing, especially in a short week. I mean, the Vikings had all but ruled out Dalvin Cook leading into this game because it was going to be probably a two-week injury, and they had 10 days to get him on the field. He's probably not going to be able to go. Adam Thielen had a high ankle sprain that he missed the remainder of their loss to the Lions on Sunday. Probably not enough time to turn around and get him on the field. So if you're looking at a Vikings team that in 2 weeks is now down Dalvin Cook and Adam Thielen, what film are you going to watch?
Right.
You have no idea who the Vikings offense is going to be.
Right.
I think to some degree that's an advantage to the injured team because you know your team better than the opponent does. You have no idea. Mike Tomlin doesn't know what the Vikings are going to do if those guys are not on the field as far as the specifics. You know, the distribution of labor might not change, but, you know, whoever Dalvin Cook's backup there is not Dalvin Cook. So you obviously can't expect the same level of production. So why would you focus on that? Are they going to do that? There's a lot of what ifs. And as a coach, especially in a short week, I don't think they want to get into really asking themselves those questions and figuring out the answers. You have to kind of stick to who you are and what you know and get out on the field and play the brand of football that you want to play and hope you can get the opponent into doing that. And I think that's why you see so much variation in these Thursday games. And simply put, guys are beat up. You're getting, mm-hmm. you know, 55% of the rest that you would, and you got to get back out there. For me, I would tend to favor the team that doesn't have to travel. They get home and they get that 12-hour rest period of not traveling means something in these games. Maybe not so much on, like, you played on Sunday, your opponent played on Monday. That might not matter so much. But in a Thursday week game, that's going to be tough. I don't know what version we're going to see of the Steelers. They have plenty of reason to be excited, and I know that fans are definitely excited to see the Vikings record and then to see them actually lose to the Lions and not tie them. But
right.
The reality is both of these teams are capable of beating teams in the league. I think Minnesota has a good offensive team. They're good at passing the ball. Kirk Cousins doesn't get the credit that he probably deserves for the kind of player that he is. This is not an easy game by any stretch for the Steelers. I mean, the Vikings are 3.5-point favorites, not 3-point favorites, which is kind of you know, the home field advantage. I think it's going to be a tight competitive game, but who knows? We have no idea what's going to happen. We never do on Thursdays.
You know what's interesting about if I were to tell you what the Vikings record is, just blind, most people would assume that Kirk Cousins would have, I don't know, 15 touchdowns and maybe 9-10 interceptions. His touchdown-interception ratio is phenomenal this year. I mean, it's outstanding. And that's the part that about the Vikings I find confusing, because you would assume that, well, typical Kirk, he's made some mistakes, and that's not been the case.
Kirk Cousins is kind of a weird outlier in my mind. Typically, what we see is good offense equals good quarterback. You see that in Minnesota, but good offense also usually leads to good team, especially when you have a defense the Vikings defense isn't great, but they're not terrible either.
Right.
You'd think they'd be better than they are, but the Vikings just Sunday was case in point the issue with the Vikings. They really are a team that somehow has made themselves more of a focus of the sum of their parts rather than the sum of their whole. Not everything sucks at the same time for them, but at different times it does. Cousins has been the consistent factor. Cousins is a good quarterback. You know,
I
get that he's not the coolest guy in the world. It's fun to rip on him. He has some, you know, kind of pretty notorious staff. Like, I forget if this is even broken or not, but at one point he hadn't won a primetime game in forever.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
Right.
That follows a guy around, and I understand that. But at the same time, like, there are several quarterbacks in the NFL noticeably worse than Kirk Cousins.
No doubt.
I would even go as far as to say that the team would be terrible if he wasn't there. It's hard to see them winning three games. But at the same time, he has a great game against typically kind of seen as a lowly Lions team, although I will say that while the Lions are not well-rounded, they do bring some elements to the game that are kind of tough to deal with. We've seen them play better the last few weeks, but you know, your record is what it is. Cousins played pretty well, and they didn't score until late. They didn't really get things going until late, and then their defense kind of chunked it at the end. So it's a weird set of circumstances in Minnesota right now. And I hear about this all the time. I've got a bunch of friends there, huge Vikings fans.
Yeah.
You name an aspect of the team, they hate it right now. So
yeah.
You're not getting a whole lot of consistent optimism coming out of Minnesota surrounding that team. I'm not sure if Mike Zimmer survives it, but
right.
they are capable of putting a good game together. We've seen it. You know, they beat Green Bay not that long ago. This is also similar to Pittsburgh, a really up and down team, and I think they have an advantage in their passing game that's going to be a big factor heading into Thursday.
Yeah, all those North Dakota State buddies of yours, they're not happy right now. They're not happy right now. So
they're on to the Bison now. They've given most of them give up on football around Thanksgiving anyway. Now we're it's playoff time for NDFU, so we'll focus on that.
Is it green and gold, or is it green and yellow?
They say you get probably green and yellow more, and there really isn't a dedication to gold the way that it is in Pittsburgh. But you'll hear both.
Yeah, okay.
What they say as far as gold goes, usually they're making a comment on the championships that they have.
It's closer to the Packers.
To me, those speak for themselves.
It's closer to the Packers. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's you know, they're not gonna die on that hill. It's more. The symbolism of the mascot is what they go with. It's not so much of a color thing there.
Exactly, yeah. No, my high school coach was a huge Lombardi disciple. Loved Lombardi. So we wore green jerseys, gold pants, you know, yellow pants, yellow helmets, and instead of a G, had an E on it. So it's like, you're looking around going, gee, I wonder, you know, and his name was Joe LaManna, who was an awesome guy, right? I mean, I love Joe, right? But you know, he loved Lombardi, and so we dressed like the Packers. All right,
imitation, the highest form of flattery.
I mean, we didn't play like them, but all right, Neil, thanks so much. We'll talk again next week, my friend. Thank you.
Definitely. Thanks for having me,
Neil Coulong. We'll wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. All right, great to have you with us. A little Billy Joel. Go to Madison Square Garden. They've got all the championship banners up there. There aren't that many of them. Between the Knicks and the Rangers, not that many. But they do have banners up for Elton John and Billy Joel from the number of performances each has had at the Garden. Worthless knowledge, but something most of you didn't know. That's okay. Speaking of useless knowledge, how's the staff meeting? No, just kidding.
Went about as it usually does.
Oh, my goodness. Please tell me Mertzi doesn't go. She's too smart.
Well, she does. Out of the goodness of her heart.
No, I'm telling you right now. I give her credit. I give her loyalty points. I give you loyalty points. I only have two words for the suit on the on running the meeting. Cliff notes. All right. Makes it go faster. I've got a few things to say. I gotta go. Gotta run. See ya. All right. Let's see. Tomorrow, Mark Brennan's on the show. How about that? Get Brennan on the show tomorrow and a lot more. Brought to you by Sunbury Motors. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.